Welcome on to a Tuesday night edition of the pod. I had hoped that things might get a little bit easier to decipher, and to some extent they have, but in the East, that has not been the case. Take you through the results real quickly from tonight in the Eastern Conference. Philly winning in Atlanta 121-113. JJ Redick, 28 points, 6 of 9 from 3 in that one. Ersan Ilyasova helping the tank of his old team with 26 points of his own. Those two guys combined 10 out of 17 from 3. Marco Bellinelli also had 20 points in 32 minutes. Worth watching, Dario Saric did leave the game with a chipped tooth and a lip laceration very early on. Don't know yet whether he's going to be able to play tomorrow against Milwaukee at home on the second end of the back-to-back. Imagine that he could get done. Torian Prince, 18 three-point attempts for the Hawks. He was 6 out of 18 from 3, 9 out of 25 from the field overall. That's an insane number of three-pointers from a guy who was not exactly known for his three-point shooting at this point. Elsewhere in the East, Indiana blown out at home by Charlotte. Victor Oladipo did not play. That was smart for Indiana to get down to 48-34, where they're going to be tied with some other teams, instead of to have 49 wins by themselves. So they could really improve their draft pick with that loss. Washington takes care of Boston 113-101. John Wall, 4 of 5 from 3, 12 assists, 7 rebounds, leading Washington with 29 points. Otto Porter, however, did leave the game with a right lower leg strain. Didn't come out for the start of the second half. No idea what the severity of that is, but Washington does play tomorrow against the Magic, the implications of which we will get to momentarily. And that's all that mattered in the East, so we'll get to some of the other scores that mattered when we talk about the West and the tank race and the rest of the news. So now my attempt to break down the Eastern Conference. This part of it, actually, here, why don't we start with this, what the schedule is for tomorrow. The relevant games are Toronto, already locked into number one, but can affect things for Miami. It's Toronto at Miami. Milwaukee is at Philadelphia. The Knicks are at Cleveland. Washington plays at home against Orlando. And Boston's regular season comes to an end at home against Brooklyn, but neither of those two teams figure into this race. Boston is locked into number two. So let's start with the race for the number three seed between Philly and Cleveland. A Philly win or a Cleveland loss clinches the number three seed for Philly. So if Philly beats Milwaukee, they're the three seed. If New York somehow beats Cleveland in Cleveland, Philly is the three seed. Otherwise, Cleveland will be the three seed. So you imagine Philly will certainly be trying in that game against Milwaukee. Now we get into the really crazy part. And this is basically as confusing as Vezina in the Battle of Wits against Wesley in Princess Bride. So for Milwaukee, we can kind of start with them. Unclear if Giannis is going to play with that ankle soreness, according to Matt Velasquez of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. But Milwaukee has plenty of incentive to win in theory, because if they win, they get the sixth seed. And they also, by getting the sixth seed, would keep their draft pick, which is protected 11 through 16. It would be 17. So they get to hold on to that for another year. And I presume they think they'll be better next year. And this year's draft is better than next year's, is the perception. But by winning, Milwaukee gets to six, but they cause Philly almost certainly to fall to four. So you win, you keep your draft pick, but now you have to play Cleveland in round one. So those incentives are crazy for the Bucks. And then you throw into that, you know, do they want to play Giannis, give him some more rest on that ankle? Really tough to say. I mean, some would say, hey, you know what? You're drawing dead in these playoffs anyway. So who cares if you play Cleveland? Keeping the draft pick is more important. And it just looks better if you get the sixth seed. Now, yeah, okay, they can try, but, you know, Philly is certainly going to be favored in that game, even without Embiid, maybe even without Sharks. They're just playing so well right now. They will be on the second night of a back to back, though. So a lot of really interesting things there. Now, let's stay with the Bucks' incentives. Let's say they lose. Clearly where they want to be is in the seventh seed to face Boston. That's the weakest out of Philly, Toronto, and Cleveland. Boston, as we know, is locked into the two seed. But if they lose, there are still ways they could remain sixth. although then they would play Philly, or they could fall to 7th, or they could even fall to 8th. 8th, they would play Toronto. They probably would still rather play Toronto, you would imagine, than Cleveland. So certainly it seems like just for their playoff hopes this year, losing is the better strategy, but then you throw the draft pick into play, and that makes it really nebulous. So let's say Milwaukee loses. They get the 7th seed, which is the juiciest real estate. If Toronto beats Miami in Miami, and if Washington beats Orlando. Let's talk about that Toronto-Miami game now, right? Does Toronto want to try in that game? They have nothing to play for in terms of their own seeding, of course. With the Warriors' loss today, they've now clinched home court advantage in a potential matchup against the Warriors. But would they want to manipulate it so that they are most likely to play Miami? I would say I probably would rather play Miami than Washington or Milwaukee. I don't know if they feel that way, but they increase their chances of playing Miami by winning that game in Miami. If they don't beat Miami, then it's going to be either Milwaukee or Washington that they're going to have to play. The only way they play Miami is if they beat Miami. So I think Toronto probably going to try in that game. And in fact, if they don't beat Miami, they probably get Milwaukee because Washington is going to play against Orlando. And worth noting as well that if Miami wins that game, they now get up to 6th, and it depends whether they're going to play Philly or Cleveland. You know, that's going to be a little tete-a-tete there as well for Miami. If it looks like Philly is going to lose to Milwaukee, well, actually, no, I'm sorry. That's wrong. If Miami gets to 6th, they have to be playing Philly because that would have mean that Milwaukee lost to Philly. There's no way Miami gets to 6th unless Milwaukee loses to Philly. So Miami definitely has incentive to try and win because if they get to 6th, then they have to be playing Philly. And if they win and Washington loses to Orlando, which seems unlikely but could happen, that Miami gets that great real estate at 7. Now, what about Washington? Could they screw all this up by intentionally losing to Orlando? Well, let's forget, first of all, no matter what they intend, Orlando has a crapload of incentive to lose themselves because they are currently tied with Dallas and Atlanta for the 3rd seed in the lottery. If they win, then they're stuck by themselves in 5th. So that really reduces their odds. If Orlando can lose, then they just split all of the ping pong balls from 3 through 5 equally for the 3 through 5 slots. Last point on the Milwaukee pick protection issue. If they are tied, even if they end up getting a higher seed, then there's a drawing to see who will pick lower. So the Bucks have 44 wins right now. Heat and Wizards both have 43. So if the Bucks win, they're at 45. They get the 17 pick by themselves. They keep the pick for sure. If the Bucks lose and Washington and Miami both win, all of them are at 44. The tiebreaker in the playoff scenario is irrelevant for the lottery. So there's just a drawing between those tied teams. So there'd be 3 teams. The Bucks would actually be rooting to lose that drawing, go up to 17, keep the pick. And so if they're tied with Miami and Washington, they would still have a 1/3 chance of keeping their pick. If they're tied with only one of those teams, then they would have a 50% chance at keeping their pick. So losing doesn't mean automatically that they're going to lose that pick. So again, adding a little bit to the idea that they could have some incentive to lose, but it really, there's no great answer there. So here's my guess of what's going to happen. I think Philly is going to win. They're playing better than Milwaukee. We don't know if Giannis is going to play. Not sure what the incentives are for Milwaukee. So I see Philly winning, getting the 3 seed. This is just a prediction, obviously. This could go totally wrong. I think Toronto is just a better team than Miami. I don't know, though. I mean, even when you have a little bit of something to play for, it's hard to see whether the motivation comes through. So Miami's incentives here really matter a lot, too. With Philly winning, I see Miami trying to win as well. But Toronto is just better, and I think they'll want to play Miami. And hey, you know what? It doesn't hurt to just get to go to Miami as well. And Giannis, if I'm Toronto, Giannis really scares me. Washington's offense can really scare me. They've lost to them before in the playoffs. So I think I would really rather play Miami, and I would try. So I would barely think Toronto probably wins that game, but I think that's a total toss-up. And then Washington, they might even try to tank, but I think Orlando is going to try and tank even harder. And Orlando has worse players than Washington. And it is worth noting that game is in Orlando. But nonetheless, I think Washington, Philly, and Toronto are the teams that would win. And then that would result in Philly 3, Cleveland 4, Indiana locked into 5 already, Washington 6. So if Washington is 6, in this scenario, to get to 6, Milwaukee would have had to have lost to Philly. That means Philly is 3, so you'd have Philly and Washington. Milwaukee 7, they get to play Boston, Miami 8. I think that's what is my best guess, but so many moving parts here that it's pretty difficult to say. All right, so we're going to break this up here. We'll bring in Danny. We recorded this before he left for vacation. Talk about what went wrong, what went right in our preseason predictions. Right after this, from Simple Contacts. I'm lucky enough not to need contact lenses, but my fiance definitely does. And so I told her, hey, you know what? Like, why don't you try this to renew your contacts? So she downloads the app, opens it up, and she's like, hey, you know what? Like, I have to renew my prescription. I can't do this. And I was like, oh, contraire, how about you just take this test? And in under 5 minutes, this online self-guided vision test, you can renew your prescription. They're actually bringing the doctor's office to your home. And so, yeah, it takes 5 minutes, but think of how much time you spend having to actually go in and renew your prescription. And then once you get that prescription, you pay $20 for that vision test, which obviously is far cheaper than what it would be at the doctor's office. They have free shipping. Their contact lens prices are unbeatable. And you can get $30 off your first Simple Contacts order with simplecontacts.com/capspace. That's a URL. Or enter that familiar capspace code at checkout. I'm always a little partial to the capspace code rather than the URL. It's just the capspace code just rolls off the tongue, right? The alliteration. But you could do it whichever your pleasure, simplecontacts.com/capspace, or go to simplecontacts.com and enter that capspace code at checkout to get $30 off your contacts. Worth noting that their test does test your current prescription, make sure you can still see 20/20 with that, and helps you renew that prescription. They're not going to write completely new prescriptions, and of course, you still need to go periodically to get your eye health examined. They don't do that. But what they do is let you renew your prescription in just 5 minutes. It's fantastic. Simplecontacts.com/capspace is that URL, or enter that capspace code at simplecontacts.com. Let them know that you came from us. So it's that fun time of year where we go back and look at some more of our preseason predictions. We, of course, did our over-unders. We did our awards earlier this week. But we wanted to look at the rest of our preseason predictions and see how it is that those are looking. So I talked about where our wins were really on the over-under. But let's start with who we viewed, and obviously this is not decided yet, picked as the NBA champion. I had Golden State, as I recall you did as well.
Yes, I had, so let's go conference finalists through the championship. I had the Warriors winning in 5 over the Cavs. I had Cleveland facing the Wizards in the conference finals, and the Warriors playing the Rockets.
Wizards, huh? Wow.
Yeah, I didn't feel good about it, but.
Yeah, I had Cleveland-Boston in the conference finals, Golden State in Houston, and we'll see how that all turns out. I'm not sure that, the other question we had was Golden State versus Cleveland or any other matchup as being more likely. I said that Golden State versus Cleveland was more likely. I no longer feel that way, although I still, if I had to pick the most likely matchup, I think I would go with that. But I mean, man, it's with Houston having home court and Curry's status up in the air, I mean, that could go either way for sure.
Yeah, I had the same thing. I said Warriors Cavs then, and both teams, you know, are worse than expectations. The Warriors due to injuries, the Cavs due to everything that happened to them this season. But I would say the Cavs are now they're the favorites. They're not the miles and miles and miles away favorites, but they are absolutely the favorite in the Eastern Conference.
Most valuable player, and this is what we thought would deserve it, not who would win it. I went with the top 8, actually. So here it is. I had Giannis at number 8. He's ended up finishing 4th on my ballot that we did the other day. AD at 7, he ended up at 3rd. Russell Westbrook was nowhere close to my ballot. James Harden was my winner. He was 5th. KD and Steph at 4 and 3. They both were just too injured to be on here. And then Kawhi was 2. I think this is when we knew that he might miss the start of the regular season, just barely. Because he's missed a little bit more than that. And then I had LeBron at number 1, and my thought was that if the Cavs could get into the high 50s, which I didn't predict, but I thought was possible, then LeBron would win it just as kind of a lifetime achievement award. But didn't anticipate that Harden and the Rockets would be this good, and that the Cavs would be as bad as they have been, even if they have come on lately.
My list was 5 guys, and only one of those 5 made my ballot at the end of the year. A lot of that was due to injury. Durant was 5, Westbrook 4, LeBron 3, Curry 2, Kawhi 1. Curry would have been in my top 5 had he stayed more healthy. Durant could have. It would have been kind of on the margin. Giannis and AD had really good years. I don't think he would have made it.
If he'd stayed healthy all year, I might have had him over Lillard as my number 5 this year.
Yeah, but if Steph had stayed healthy, you would have had him
over
Durant.
Yeah.
So
Steph probably would have been second to me if he'd stayed healthy all year and played at the same level. But the reason I had Harden lower was simply that I thought he might take a little bit of a step back performance-wise. You know, I think this is age 29 season. But also, we just thought he would be splitting so much with Chris Paul. And I think for both the narrative and the hierarchy there, it was fortuitous for his candidacy that Paul basically missed the first, like, month of the season after just playing that one game against the Warriors. So that really got him on the right track. And he was the clear alpha there even more than we might have thought that he would be. I mean, 36% usage. I didn't expect that it's basically where he was at last year. So I didn't expect that would remain the same. And then I didn't think just that Houston would be as good of a team as they have been. I thought they'd be very good, certainly, but I didn't think they'd be quite this good.
We can jump to Coach of the Year, and I'm surprised at who I had, and it ended up looking a lot better than I anticipated. So I had Greg Popovich number 1, Brad Stevens number 2, Mike D'Antoni number 3.
Yeah,
not
and this was for me the coaches that deserved it. I had and I thought that Greg Popovich and Steve Kerr, the two best coaches in the NBA. I think the Warriors' effort level has disappointed some this year. Kerr has been hamstrung to some degree by just the lack of overall shooting on the roster. It hasn't really been anything he could do about that, but he hasn't been in the conversation at all this year, even for me, who thinks that this should kind of be more about who the best coach is rather than just, you know, whose team surprised the most. So Popovich ended up being my number 4, and then I also had a list of who I thought would win it, and I think I actually had Quinn Snyder at number 2. Stevens was not in the discussion really because we thought that actually Boston wasn't going to hit their over-under and they were going to disappoint, and they didn't hit their over-under, but because of the injuries, they sure as hell didn't disappoint. So I think Stevens will win it. He would be my pick as well. Snyder was my number 2, so I liked Eric Spoelstra to be higher. Doc Rivers, who we probably didn't even talk enough about on our awards podcast, he was pretty good. And then Frank Vogel, if the Magic make the playoffs, was a note that I had.
Hey, if they had made the playoffs, he certainly could have been.
Well, I mean, and remember what we were thinking at the time was, hey, the East, 8th seed, I had predicted the Pistons, 39 wins, were going to get the 8th seed. The Magic were a team that, and actually, you know, if the Magic had been healthy all year, they might have approached the high 30s. And if that had been the number that would have been needed, maybe they could have gotten it. I mean, a lot would have had to go right, obviously, for me. And that is a pretty laughable prediction, but I stand by, or I won't stand by it, but I'll at least defend what the thinking was to have him on there.
I believe that first coach fired is the quickest I have ever had a season prediction correct, and that is Earl Watson. And Earl Watson was fired.
Three games.
So that was pretty satisfying. The guys I had as other contenders, none of them got fired. Gentry, Hornacek, and Frank Vogel, though two of those three could very well be looking for new jobs, as friend of the podcast Mark Stein talked about a week ago.
I had picked Alvin Gentry. I thought that the Pels were going to disappoint this year. That didn't turn out to be the case. He looks to be quite safe there. Earl Watson was my number 2, so I feel better about that, but not as good as you. Jason Kidd, I had on there. He did get fired during the season. Brett Brown, I thought, you know, not even that I thought he was a bad coach, but I felt like the Sixers could disappoint and that he wasn't really the Colangelo's man. And so if they did disappoint, they'd kind of be looking for an excuse to get him out of there. He obviously, in the coach of the year conversation, was great. Fred Hoiberg, you know, I think actually has done an okay job until he started taking on the tank commander role. Stan Van Gundy, I noted, might be stripped of his personnel powers. And then, some of the other ones, Vogel, Hornacek, they're probably going to be gone. Nate McMillan, certainly not going to be gone. Mike Malone, maybe will be. We'll see what ends up happening with him.
Defensive player of the year, and again, deserves rather than will win. My logic, first of all, I think Kawhi is a fabulous defensive player when he's healthy. And I actually thought that the MVP and defensive player of the year cases would kind of be simpatico, that he would be so valuable in that way that it would help. And as much as it shouldn't, offensive players end up getting more buzz for defensive player of the year. I had Draymond second, who was the reigning defensive player of the year, and then Gobert third. Gobert ended up A, playing more than Kawhi, and B, having a substantially better defensive season than Draymond, who was below my expectations.
Yeah. I think we were all pretty much on the same pitch. I'd Gobert at number 1, Draymond 2, Kawhi 3, and Joel Embiid as 4, if he played enough. And it's my pick ended up being Gobert 1, Embiid 2, and one of those two guys, it feels nearly certain to win it. Sixth man in terms of who would deserve it, I had Andre Iguodala, though I noted that he could take a step back this year, and that certainly Iguodala had been my pick the last two seasons. That certainly was the case. He wasn't in the conversation this year. Number two was Eric Gordon for me, kind of in the conversation. Nerlens Noel.
Well, for that like 2 week stretch.
Oh, by the way, do you want to address this just batshit insane argument that the Mavs somehow like intentionally tanked Nerlens Noel's value as a shot across the bow to any other potential restricted free agent in their system to never take a qualifying offer again?
Sure. The single stupidest part of a stupid argument is the fact that Dallas didn't know they were going to be out of the playoffs until much later in the season. And the reason Nerlens Noel fell out of the rotation was because he wasn't good. He was certainly talented, and you could make an argument that the long-term play would have been to keep him out there, but Noel just hadn't brought it. It had been big struggles offensively, defensively, hadn't been as crisp and as active as he ended up being later in the season, and the incentives just completely weren't in place. They were not like the Bulls and the Hawks, let's say, who everybody pretty much knew they were going to be bad. Dallas, if they had had a better record in close games, could have been really competitive, and also, you know, Saul Emejri, let's say, he played with a lot more fire, and the Mavericks played significantly better when Emejri was on the floor in those early stretches than they did with Noel, and they gave Noel a full shot. I think it was the first month of the year he was playing at least 15 to 20 minutes in almost every game.
Yeah, I think he had a negative 18 net rating before he went under the knife with his thumb surgery, and they have gone out of their way to be incredibly effusive about him publicly. It was certainly in their interest that he actually be good and be good enough to sign it. And I mean, wow, look at all these like awesome guys on rookie scale contracts with restricted free agency negotiations coming up. Wow. I mean, all right, fine, they traded for Doug McDermott, but I don't think they saw that in the plans. I'm sure Dennis Smith is going to be quaking in his boots 3 years from now because of what they did to Nerlens. I mean, so this idea that number one, all of these people are going to be, these agents are going to be like, oh yeah, remember what they did to Nerlens Noel when he took the qualifying offer? We can't take the qualifying offer. That's ridiculous that like the people are going to be focusing in on that 4 years from now when Dennis Smith's a restricted free agent. Number two, the guy sucked. I mean, like, he was terrible. I'm sorry they didn't want to play someone who was terrible. Like, that's the biggest flaw in the argument. It's just, it's really just, like, I'm very much pro-labor. Don't worry. Like, I don't like restricted free agency. I'm on the side of the players in most of these disputes, but you just have to be seeing the situation through such a preconceived notion to come up with this argument. It's just unbelievable to me. Like, that's, and to make, like, the reason I'm so worked up about is not only because it's so stupid, but it's so stupid and you're using it to like attack people for like doing something mean and unfair in the organization. Yeah, I know the Mavs aren't the most popular organization in basketball right now, but I mean, come on, like if you're gonna go after someone's reputation about something like that, like how about you actually have just a little bit of ammo to back it up?
Well, I'll go through my sixth man of the year as, yeah. as a super fun transition from that. I had Eric Gordon number one, Lou Williams two, Tyreek three, Andre Iguodala four. And it was probably a little bit closer to yours, but again, same basic through lines.
Yeah, and for me, I had Lou number four. I did note that I thought it would be Lou Williams. I just didn't think he would be as effective. And as it turned out, he easily deserved it as well, and I would be beyond shocked if he didn't win it. Wow, Rookie of the Year is probably like the most embarrassing failure of any of these, as far as I'm concerned.
I don't know. For me, having four of the five MVP guys on the ballot was pretty bad, but though that was a lot of injury-based, and this was not injury-based. I thought it was a two-man race between Lonzo Ball and Dennis Smith. I was completely convinced of it, partially because of their counting stats, and also I thought those guys could put it together, worried about Smith's defense, and also because we had so much uncertainty with Ben Simmons, who I had third. We disagreed on the awards podcast on who should win it. I said Ben Simmons, you said Jamal Murray. Not Jamal Murray, the other Donovan Mitchell. I have Jamal Murray on the brain for the next question, but I also think Ben Simmons is going to win, not that that matters because we're predicting who's going to deserve it. But yeah, not seeing Mitchell coming, even though he had a good summer league, you know, I don't know where he would have been if I'd extended out this ballot, but he certainly would have been lower than he deserved.
Yeah, I did a top six and Mitchell was nowhere on there. At this time, I was thinking that Mitchell was going to be, you know, he wasn't even supposed to be starting at the very beginning of the year. You know, that was going to be Rodney Hood and Ricky Rubio were going to be starting this team, right? And yeah, he certainly was able to wedge his way in part because I think there are some early injuries there. But I was looking at him as, you know, kind of a 3-and-D guy, right? I mean, based on his statistical performance at Louisville and the fact that he seemed like a pretty good shooter, but, you know, not someone that you looked at as like really some advanced ball handler who's going to get to the basket and he's going to play good D. And, you know, Mike Schmitz, David Locke, you guys were right. I was wrong. Smith got the opportunity that we thought he would. Just the Mavs were worse than we thought they would be. And he was so inefficient that, you know, but really, I think a big part of it too was that he was just passed by other guys. And then Simmons didn't think he'd be good defensively. That was not the case. I mean, he's made probably more of an improvement of any player that I can ever remember seeing from their last year in college to their rookie year, probably helped by the fact that he spent a whole year on the sidelines and being in an NBA system and watching games and just understanding he's a smart player. I didn't think he would be a good finisher around the rim. That's not been the case as well either. You know, he really has improved that aspect also, and the way he's pushed the ball has been incredible, and the Sixers have been great this year too. So either of those guys, and then Ball, the shooting struggles were just so bad. I mean, we knew he was going to start from day one. He's also had a lot of injury issues. And De'Aaron Fox and Markelle Fultz were in there. Fox has been basically just as inefficient as Smith was. Fultz, I had Kyle Kuzma sixth at least. He ended up being fourth on my ballot, so I was not too far off there. Simmons was third for me. But yeah, that was one of the worst jobs that we've ever done with that, I think.
Yeah, probably up there. And for what award that we like doing for this is Sophomore of the Year. And we deliberately excluded Joel Embiid from this, considering how great he looked. And also remember, Joel Embiid's health was an issue. And I predicted Jamal Murray, and he's certainly in the conversation here. It's actually pretty hard to pick a single guy. But if I were to say who I think is the best player, I think I probably had Jamal top of the remaining guys. No, I didn't in prospect ranking. So I'm still going to go with Jamal Murray.
Yeah, my four were Jamal Murray, Malcolm Brogdon, Jalen Brown, and Brandon Ingram. And Brogdon has missed a bunch of time this year. And, you know, I don't want to say he took a step back, but he was supplanted as the starting point guard by Bledsoe, got yanked around a ton by Kidd as well. So, I would say it's probably Murray too. I mean, Murray is probably a top 15. And remember, this is a really bad rookie class last year, other than Embiid. So Murray's probably a top 15 offensive point guard right now, top 20. Jalen Brown would be number two, really contributing at close to an all defense level. His shooting has really, really come along as well. But Murray, probably the best, certainly offensively at this point. And I think I feel the best about his career going forward of any of those guys who were rookies last year, outside of Embiid.
Most improved player is the only one where I separated out predictions and deserves. I'm not going to go through the predictions, partially because I listed off eight guys and partially because none of those eight were anywhere close to my ballot. For deserves, it was an interesting group. I chose Karl Anthony Towns, Jamal Murray, and Miles Turner. Murray and Turner, I think, really have improved this year. Turner has come on a little bit late. He dealt with that concussion and a few other weird things early in the year. Murray has improved as we expected with a second year guy. And then Towns, remarkable offensive player, but just he hasn't made the strides defensively over the season that I hoped he would.
I at least had Victor Oladipo on my list of potential candidates, which was nice. He obviously would be a shocker to not win this award. Certainly deserved it for us. Thon Maker probably didn't deserve to be anywhere near this list. Elfrid Payton probably didn't deserve to be anywhere near this list. I had picked D'Angelo Russell. I think he's had a disappointing year, both due to the injuries and just overall inefficiency and how bad they've been when he's been on the floor. I also mentioned Kristaps Porzingis, who certainly would have been in the conversation at least early in the year, and then obviously got hurt, so that was no longer the case. The player who most beat regression, aka the LeBron James Award, will again be won by LeBron James.
And we predicted it. That's one we didn't do in the award show, partially because it has basically been retired. And I predicted the runner-up being Chris Paul. I think he would be my runner-up. And then the other guy who I think deserves a lot of praise, this was his age 32 season, LaMarcus Aldridge, has had a really wonderful year, improved defensively, and his offensive game not regressing, actually improving off of what he did last season.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned him. So our thought for biggest surprise team, I thought that it would technically be Minnesota just because they won the most games compared to where they were last year. And I think, are they going to have the biggest improvement compared to last year?
I think it's the Sixers.
Yeah, you're right. Because the Sixers, were 27 last year and Minnesota was 31.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I also thought that in terms of like what most people were going to project, I thought Miami might be it, but that's not been the case. They've been right around, I think, where people projected just slightly better. Denver as well, I thought would be better than a lot of people thought, but you know, that hasn't
in the case. I thought that Denver had like a lot of upside if Millsap played all year and could really improve the defense, and they maintained that number one level of offense that they had, which is their offense is disappointed a little bit this year. Who did you have as your biggest surprise team?
Like you did, I separated out from the popular interpretations and then for us. And I thought Denver and Utah for most people would exceed expectations by the most. I would say that has been pretty good for Utah. I mean, they're not the single most, but they're in that conversation. I mean, being 47, I mean, they might end up being the four seed. That's pretty awesome. And Denver, especially if they had stayed healthy, they would have been right in that mix. And then the one I got really wrong was for us, because we were both lower on them, I thought there was a chance that Atlanta could exceed expectations on this idea that I talked about in the Over Under podcast, that they would stay competitive, Hawks University could produce some new pupils, and that didn't happen at all.
Yeah, and the actual most surprising team, Indiana, is going to beat their Over Under by the most this year. And I also had Boston, although no one could have predicted all the weird twists and turns that it's taken for them to, you know, just looking at their number of wins on the surface, we would have thought they'd be kind of right about where they were. But then Hayward went down and Irving has missed all this time, and they've had a lot of injury issues, Smart as well. Most disappointing team, I at least acknowledged Memphis. Even though I thought that Memphis would be good, I acknowledged that they had a very decent chance of regressing. I think I had picked them for 42 wins in the eighth seed, and they of course came nowhere near there, but I at least acknowledged that was they had a bunch of downside. Boston, we thought would be disappointing. That was terrible. Milwaukee was a pick for most disappointing. They were actually my second most disappointing team. And I thought Cleveland was going to be pretty good this year. I thought their defense would be much improved. They were my most disappointing team. But there weren't, other than injury related, there were not that many disappointing teams ultimately this year.
I would agree with that. The two that I picked preseason were Orlando and Memphis. You could make an argument relative to expectations that they did, though I think injuries were such a big explanation for both of those that it's different. The one that I got really wrong was saying that over expectations that Philly would be the biggest disappointment. Just that over under was just so striking to me. I'm like, oh man, they're not going to be that kind of team. And I didn't think Embiid was going to stay as healthy as he did, all of those sorts of things. So that one I definitely got wrong. And then a team I put a question mark around was the Lakers. And I would say the Lakers come out of this season feeling better about where they are than I expected, but their win total is not that far off of what I expected.
Yeah, I had picked Philly as well as most disappointing, just because we thought that over under of 42.5 based on their health. This was one season where betting against teams based on health who had track records of not being healthy didn't really work out that well. Maybe you could say Memphis we should have, but we didn't. But we bet against the Clippers in some ways. I thought that they would really disappoint due to injuries, and they had all the probably worse injuries than we would have expected them to have, if anything, and they still were as good or better than expected. And Philly was another one that we've had against mostly because of injuries, and they were better than expected as well, both in health and then just in the quality of the individual players. Also, most disappointing player, I mean, I had a very extensive list here, and I think it's just interesting to go through it and see like how many of these we actually hit on, but I'll let you start that off.
I only had one guy, and it was Andre Drummond, and he had some really nice flashes this year. There were some times that I was really impressed with his defense, and offensively his passing especially was steps, so he certainly is not in this conversation, but I understand why I picked him. You know, he always seemed like somebody I think that people, after that rookie year when he was so good, so young, it was the idea that he was on a trajectory, and I still feel like that trajectory was overstated for him, but he's had a better year than I anticipated, so kudos.
So here's my list. I guess I'm really a negative person apparently, and I guess I really am negative because we didn't even say biggest surprise player as a category. We'll have to do that after this.
I thought that kind of coincided with most improved. That's the way that I really thought about it, so I didn't actually fill in anything for that, but if you did it, then
I had Josh Richardson, D'Angelo Russell, Aaron Gordon, and Derek Favors in that, but you know, I don't think any of those were really great hits. Aaron Gordon, the way he started off the year, I was looking pretty smart, and Favors has had a bounce back year, though he's probably had an underrated year, but he hasn't reached the level of being, you know, close to kind of a thought of as a top 40, top 30 player the way he was back when he was healthy. And Richardson, he's been pretty good for sure. I mean, I think he's been, but I don't know if he's like shocked people necessarily. But most disappointing, here is my list. And I think if I remember correctly, this was kind of in order. Number one was Dwayne Wade. I would say that I got that one pretty good, considering he just got traded away from Cleveland to Miami for nothing. And when he was on the team, they were just so bad defensively, and had a terrible culture, and he was a big part of that.
Yeah, I'd count that as
Markelle Fultz. Yeah, you know, despite the fact that he's looked decent-ish, I mean, you know, not being able to even attempt a three-pointer. Yeah, I'd say that's kind of disappointing. Oh, he did attempt a three-pointer the other day against Detroit when there was 1 second left in the quarter. Reggie Jackson actually played a little bit better than I thought he might, but then got injured again. I also had Victor Oladipo as a potential most disappointing player, even though I also had him as a most improved candidate, I think that's fair to acknowledge that things could go either way. That obviously was wrong. Blake Griffin, I would say would you say he's in there? Is that a fair to put him on that?
Yeah, I think that would be fair. It's also crazy because he's probably most disappointing player to Pistons fans just because the way that season turned out.
Yeah, and he also got hurt for a month as well.
Mm-hmm. Back when it looked like the Clippers season was done. Remember that? Yeah.
Andrew Wiggins was on the list. He was your pick for most disappointing player, though I argued against that. The guy who I ended up picking, Carmelo Anthony, did not actually show up on this. Drew Holiday I picked. That was unfair. He had that huge contract, but he has pretty much lived up to that this season.
Really nice year for him.
Porzingis, I thought, maybe could disappoint with Melo, and I mean, he's disappointed with the ACL tear, but he certainly played well. Two that I will say that I got right is George Hill and Zach Randolph. Shockingly enough, they did not push the Kings towards playoff contention.
Yeah, and since this was recorded long after the over-unders, I was on board with you there because this was recorded mid-October, and by that point, I turned on the Kings.
Stanley Johnson, another really disappointing year shooting the ball, been in and out of the starting lineup, probably has played more than he's deserved, frankly, due to a lack of other options there. And then Nicola Batum hasn't been horrible. We knew that he had that elbow injury, so that was part of the reason, but he's just been one of these guys with the Hornets who's played just a little bit worse than you might have hoped, and that's why they're out of the playoffs.
For Executive of the Year, I predicted Sam Presti would both deserve it and receive it. He will do neither, though the Paul George trade, you know, they still did get Paul George. That looks very different now. The Melo trade looks very different now. And I am happy that they were willing to pay, the ownership was willing to pay the luxury tax, but yeah, he was not in that mix with the way things turned.
Yeah, I had Presti as well as my number one. I had Tom Thibodeau as my number two, and he still deserved to be in this conversation for me for getting Butler, although as you noted it and convinced me, he probably should be at the lower end of the conversation, if not in it all, in part because of that max extension for Wiggins and some of the supporting moves. And then Kobe Altman, who I thought did really well in really tough circumstances, and I still stand by that with the Kyrie Irving trade, especially with it coming out that he threatened to have a surgery and sit out the season, which maybe he would have done, maybe he wouldn't have, but he apparently needed a surgery. It's been clear now with him out for the season, and he had to have that tension wire removed that was bothering him. So those are the only three I mentioned. We both agreed on Daryl Morey. Dennis Lindsay, I think, was my number two. Danny Ainge, who we had thought didn't do a good job with that Kyrie trade and the Tatum trade. You know, those both are looking not as rosy as right at the start of the year, but still pretty good. So those would be the ones that were in there. We totally missed on that, I would say.
Yep, I think that's
fair. Any overall takeaways before we depart on this?
This was such a strange year in terms of injuries, like, because certain guys that we were really worried about, like Joel Embiid, stayed pretty healthy, other than getting hit in the face by Markelle Fultz's shoulder. And Kawhi, we knew there was something, but that becoming a much bigger, the Warriors guys being hurt a lot. But I don't know, I was very satisfied with this year. And I think what I'm most happy with was that there were more, in a lot of ways, there were more positive stories than negative stories. Like Victor Oladipo is just such a wonderful part of this season and the way that he is really driving the Pacers to it. And a lot of the other teams, you know, like if, for example, Denver, I think Denver's had a good season. They would have been better if Millsap had stayed healthy, and you know, all those kind of things. Like, I think there were more surprises than disappointments this year.
Yeah, well, and then you just look at the way the league is with a record 18 teams over 500. That's part of why that's been the case, right? And even the teams that have disappointed, pretty much all of them have managed to stay afloat much more than we thought they would, other than Memphis. I mean, that's been the one that's really been just totally taken out of it by injuries. Other than that, I mean, the only other really disappointing team you'd say that's going to not make the playoffs is Charlotte, I would say. And even Detroit, yeah, they're going to not make the playoffs. They had hoped to. They had a promising start to the season. But, I mean, they're going to win right around the number of games that I predicted for them, too, and right around where their over-under was. So it's, I mean, there haven't been that many teams that really have just been like, oh, God, this has been awful. I think, yeah.
Other than the teams that we knew were going to be like that in the first place, like the Suns and the Hawks and the Kings, those sorts of things.
Yeah, maybe a lesson, and we talked about this this a little bit on over under is, and maybe this will change with the different lottery incentives next year, is if a team is going to be good, pick it's over, especially if it's kind of in the mid tier, you think you're going to be in playoff contention. And then if you think they're not going to be in playoff contention, pick the under, because they will do their damnedest to make sure they hit that. But this has been an unprecedented year in terms of the tanking, in terms of the tanking eight all being around the same number of wins. And so there was really a lot of benefits that could be gained. You know, you could, the Bulls, if they had won a few fewer games, like could be up in the top three. They're probably gonna be like 8 or 9. So there's, that was a rarity as well this year. You know, you're not gonna have that every year. You'll have teams, you know, yeah, okay, maybe we can tank and pick up a spot or two, but the incentives for tanking were so much greater this year because everyone was bunched up, you know, starting like mid-February or so.
Yeah, and in some ways that was also attributable to the Kings and the Suns in that early stretch having more wins than their expected total due to the record. So that helped bunch everybody up, because if they had played to their record, then they would have been a mile ahead of everybody else.
Yes, ahead. And Dallas, in the opposite vein, playing so much worse than their point differential, added another team in. The Porzingis injury added the Knicks into the mix as well. The Bulls playing better in like that December spot. I mean, the Bulls would have been, you know, a 15-win team if they'd played the way they'd played for the first month of the season all year.
All right, so that'll do it for this segment. I'm going to come back, do the West playoff picture and the end of the tank race as well. But first, this from LendingClub.com. With its unexpected repairs, medical expenses, credit card debt, a little money can make a big difference. They give you access to low rates on loans of up to $40,000 for almost any purpose. If you want to take control of your debt, make home improvements. I had credit card debt when I was younger. I would have loved to have had Lending Club available. The way you get started with them is you go to LendingClub.com, enter the amount of money you need, and see if you're approved in minutes. Pick the offer that's right for you, and the money can be in your account in just days. They've helped millions of people with over $31 billion in loans for more than 10 years. It's much easier than going to a bank, and they offer lower rates than high interest credit cards. Again, that's consolidating that credit card debt at an actual reasonable rate is a great way to use LendingClub.com. And of course, what you want to do is use that slash Capspace URL, lendingclub.com/Capspace. Check your rate for free. Checking your rate won't impact your credit score. That's lendingclub.com/Capspace. Easy to remember because we talk about Capspace all the time on the program. Lendingclub.com/Capspace. All loans made by WebBank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. All right, here we go. The Western Conference. First, we'll catch you up on tonight's results. The Jazz completely destroyed the Warriors by 40, even though the Warriors played their guys to some degree. They got killed when they were playing their guys. 119-79. Klay Thompson hilariously went 9 out of 27 playing 35 minutes and was negative 40 because he wanted to score over 20 points and get to a 20 point per game average. He finally got 23 points and was subbed out in the fourth quarter with them down by 40. For the Jazz, Donovan Mitchell, extremely efficient, 22 points, 8 of 12 from the field, and plus 37 in that win. Nobody for the Jazz had to play more than 28 minutes, big for them, with them going on the road to Portland tomorrow night. So that was the only game that mattered for the playoff race. However, the Suns did beat the Mavs 124-97, and you'll recall that the Suns had already clinched the worst spot in the lottery. The Mavs needed to lose to preserve that tie for third. They had a disastrous 54-44 lead at the half, but that was solved by playing Aaron Harrison all 48 minutes. And Cal Collinsworth, 44 minutes. Neither of those two gentlemen, by the way, is a point guard. They played Yogi Ferrell only 7 minutes. Even Doug McDermott was deemed too good to play in this one. Jonathan Motley led the Mavs in shots. He had 21 points on 19 shots. And they also played Jalen Jones 35 minutes, Dorian Finney-Smith 41 minutes. And the fatigue and the fact that the Suns had nothing to lose for allowed the Suns to outscore the Mavs 80-43 in the second half. And for the Suns, Alec Peters had 36 points on 8 of 13 from 3 off the bench. Josh Jackson and Devin Booker, of course, did not play in this one. Alan Williams didn't play. Each team only played 8 guys. Really, I did not watch this game. I would love to go back and see
if not only were the Mavs playing bad guys, but were they like actively trying to lose at the end or not. So that's what we've got. Now it's just worth discussing where the standings are. Houston and Golden State are currently 1-2. The Jazz and Blazers have 48-33 records. They're 3-4 as of now. The New Orleans, San Antonio, and OKC, all of whom have clinched, are tied at 47-34. The Wolves and Nuggets are 46-35. So now let's talk about tomorrow's games. Worth noting that both in the East and the West, every game starts at either 8 Eastern or at 10:30 Eastern, and the only 10:30 Eastern game that matters is Jazz Blazers, and both those teams will be trying to win regardless. You would imagine, especially with Golden State looking so bad in the 2 seed lately, they'd probably want to play them rather than Houston. Even if Steph Curry might be back, he probably won't be 100%. So I'd probably be angling certainly to play Golden State over Houston in the second round, but a long way to go for that. So there's that Utah-Portland game. Denver-Minnesota obviously is the play-in game there. San Antonio and New Orleans in New Orleans. That Denver-Minnesota game is in Minnesota, by the way. And then Memphis at OKC. All of the teams have clinched the playoffs, as you know, except Denver and Minnesota. So let's start with that game. Loser goes home. That's only happened twice before in NBA history. In 1995, which is the year after Denver pulled that miracle run from the 8th seed, they again got the 8th seed by beating Sacramento. And then in 1997, Washington beat Cleveland. That was the Chris Webber team that lost to the Bulls in a hard-fought first-round series. So here's what happens if Denver wins. Ironically enough, even though they're playing for their playoff lives, they can't be 8th because San Antonio and New Orleans play each other. So one of those teams is only going to have 47 wins, as will Denver. And Denver has the tiebreaker over both of those teams. So if Denver wins, the New Orleans-San Antonio loser gets the 8th seed and has to play Houston in the first round. So again, plenty of motivation in that New Orleans-San Antonio game as well. If Minnesota wins, they're only going to be 8th. And I guess I should go back really quickly here and say that all these scenarios assume that OKC is going to beat Memphis. And we'll talk more about that in a second. There's a lot of reason to believe that OKC is going to do that. So if Minnesota wins, they're the 8th seed. Unless New Orleans loses at home to San Antonio, Minnesota has the tiebreaker over New Orleans. So that would make Minnesota 7, New Orleans 8. Let's go now to the New Orleans-San Antonio loser. New Orleans is going to be 8th for sure if they lose and have to play Houston. San Antonio will be 8th if they lose and Denver wins. They will be 7th if they lose and Minnesota wins. So again, that New Orleans-San Antonio loser is going to be either 7th or 8th and have to play Golden State or Houston. And especially Houston is so deadly there. Now let's turn to Utah and Portland. Utah is the 3rd seed if they win, and we do have one matchup now that is all but guaranteed. We just don't know what seeds they're going to be, and that's Utah playing against Oklahoma City. And you might say, oh, well, hey, wait a minute, like Utah is playing really well. OKC is another good team. Wouldn't OKC want to try and avoid them? Well, by losing to Memphis? No, probably not, because if OKC loses, they are guaranteed to be 8th, and they'd have to play Houston, and they sure as hell don't want to do that. So OKC is going to be trying in that game. Also, Memphis is not playing Marc Gasol, Tyreke Evans, JaMychal Green, Chandler Parsons, Jarrell Martin, Wayne Telton, Andrew Harrison, and of course Mike Conley is also out for the season. So it's going to be, in all likelihood, Utah or OKC. If Utah wins, that's the 3-6 series. Kind of too bad that those two are playing each other, because I think like those are the two best teams from 3 and below. But, so it would be nice maybe if both those could make it to the second round. But on the other hand, we're guaranteed, I think, an awesome series with a lot of talent on the floor. If Utah loses to Portland, that makes OKC the 4th seed, Utah the 5th seed. So OKC would have home court advantage if Utah loses, and they would be in the Houston side of the bracket at the 4-5. If Utah wins, it's the 3-6, and Utah has home court. So plenty of motivation for Utah in that Portland game to get 3, have home court advantage, and they've played really well against the Warriors this year and have not played well as well against Houston. So a ton of motivation for Utah. For OKC, the only options are that they could be 4th or 6th playing Utah, or they would be 8th if they lost to Memphis, which they are not going to do. Let's say Utah wins. So Utah wins, they're 3, OKC is 6. In that scenario, Portland is 4, and that would make the winner of New Orleans and San Antonio 5. The highest the winner of New Orleans-San Antonio can get is 5. And that is if Utah wins. If Utah loses, they're the 5th seed. The winner of New Orleans-San Antonio is 6th. So I guess we'll game it out again. What do we think is going to happen? I don't like the way Portland is playing lately. I think Utah is going to win that game, especially they got some decent rest tonight. Didn't have to play that hard against Golden State. So I think Utah is going to be 3 again. A lot of this can change. That makes Portland 4. Seems like New Orleans playing at home. They've been on fire lately. I think New Orleans gets 5. 6 is OKC in that scenario. And then San Antonio really rooting for Minnesota to win because San Antonio is the tiebreaker over Minnesota. They don't have it over Denver. I'm guessing Minnesota playing at home has to be the favorite over Denver, although obviously Denver's been playing really well lately. We don't know what the minute situation is going to be for Jimmy Butler. Tibbs talked about it before their game against Memphis on Monday as a guideline and declined to specify what that guideline was. But if they're down, you have to imagine that Jimmy Butler, they're not exactly going to show a ton of restraint with him. So let me try and wrap that up one more time. If Denver wins, they're 7th. If Minnesota wins, they're 8th, unless New Orleans loses to San Antonio at home. That means Minnesota would be 7th. Neither of those teams can be higher than 7th, assuming, of course, this is all based on OKC beating Memphis. New Orleans-San Antonio. New Orleans is 8th for sure if they lose. San Antonio is 8th if Denver wins, 7th if Minnesota wins. Utah is 3 if they win, 5 if they lose. OKC is 4 if Utah loses, and Utah-OKC would be the 4-5. If Utah wins, OKC is 6, and Utah-OKC would be 3-6. Portland is 3 if they win, 4 if they lose to Utah. And the winner of New Orleans, San Antonio, the highest they can get is 5th. They are 5th if Utah wins. If Utah loses, Utah is 5th, and the winner of New Orleans, San Antonio is 6th. All right, let's talk the tank race now. Phoenix and Memphis locked into 1 and 2 seeds. Orlando, we mentioned, they have to lose to get that tie for 3rd, otherwise they're 5th. Sacramento plays the Rockets at home. You have to imagine that tonight, especially with Luka Mbamute having suffered another shoulder dislocation of unknown severity on a dunk attempt against the Lakers in a meaningless game, the Rockets played their guys tonight. I'm guessing nobody is going to play for them. So Sacramento could very easily end up winning that game. And if they do, this is the last year they have their pick because 2019 is going to either Boston or Philly. They could end up in a tie for 7th with the Bulls, who are playing at the Pistons. Sacramento right now at 26 wins. So they cannot get any higher than 6th. They'll either be 6th or tied for 6th. I should have said tied for 6th, depending on what happens in Chicago. If Sacramento wins and Chicago loses at Detroit, they'd both have 27 wins and be tied for 6th. New York and Brooklyn right now are tied at 28 wins. New York is almost certainly going to lose at Cleveland. Brooklyn, interestingly, plays at Boston, who, of course, traded that Brooklyn pick to Cleveland. Boston might have some incentive to lose, both to reduce the value of their competitor's pick, Cleveland, and also help the optics. Not sure whether that's going to actually add up that much or not. And Brooklyn has been trying lately. They've actually won 3 straight and are 5-5 in their last 10. So here's guessing that Brooklyn probably beats Boston in Boston tomorrow, ends up the 9 seed in the lottery. The Lakers have clinched 10th by virtue of their loss today to Houston. That pick will go to Philly. Charlotte has clinched 11th. Their victory over the Pacers tonight was costly. They could have been tied for 10th. Detroit, that pick will go to the Clippers, will be 12 seed. Clippers themselves, 13th. So in all likelihood, the Clippers will have 12 and 13. And then number 14 will be the Denver-Minnesota loser. Also very interesting, if you are a Hawks fan, you should be rooting for Minnesota to lose tomorrow because that would bump your pick up from a tie for 18th and could potentially be even lower than that to 14th. So you remember the Adrian Payne trade is how Minnesota has... Oh, wait, actually, no, I'm sorry. That is totally wrong. If you are a Hawks fan, you're actually rooting for Minnesota to win because that pick is lotto protected. So I'd forgotten about that the Payne trade, we just all assumed Minnesota would be in the playoffs by now. So you're actually rooting for Minnesota to win as a Hawks fan. I apologize. And then also noteworthy, we mentioned the little tankathon aspects of Milwaukee trying to keep their pick in concert with the playoff seeding. Well, Phoenix has an interesting view because they have both Milwaukee's pick if Milwaukee is worse than 17th. And they have Miami's pick, which is 1-7 protected. So that's going regardless. Miami is in the playoffs. So if you are a Phoenix fan, you are rooting for Milwaukee to win. No, I'm sorry. You are rooting for Milwaukee to lose and Miami to win, thus pushing Milwaukee down and causing that pick to go to you this year. And the Miami pick gets a little worse, but you're also getting a whole other pick with that Milwaukee pick. Last bit of news from today, and I will apologize that everything we've talked about on the show here has been so disjointed on this Memphis ownership story, but a lot of the reporting has been contradictory or incomplete. That Sports Business Journal article seemed to have a lot of wrong stuff in it when it was they initially reported that the buy sell had brought in. So Zach Lowe, who is probably the most reliable person that you can look to, reported today that Kaplan and Strauss owned about 30% of the franchise and that the valuation was closer to between $1.3 and $1.4 billion. And so Kaplan and Strauss went all out to jack up the valuation and to either get the team or to get paid, and they are definitely going to get paid. So that means that Para is going to have to pay out between $390 and $420 million. That is a lot of money to Kaplan and Strauss, and one might suspect that that's part of why Memphis is potentially going to keep JB Bickerstaff rather than hiring a new replacement. And you could also see them trying to reduce payroll, because the next rumor, of course, is that Para is then gonna, with having consolidated the team, is gonna try to sell the team and make some money off of this. That's just what the thought is, but we finally at least have some clarity on how much the valuation was. I don't think the Grizzlies are worth between $1.3 and $1.4 billion. This unique nature of the buy-sell clause drove up the price, I think, in ways that we talked about before. And Para's put a lot of money into the team now if he's, in fact, going to buy these guys out. And Tim Bontemps also contributing to the reporting, noting that both Kaplan and Strauss are going to get bought out by Para. So, all right, that will do it for today. Danny will be back tomorrow. We're going to talk about all these games. And then Thursday, we will do our playoff series breakdown. So lots of awesome content coming the next couple of days. Hope you enjoyed this one. I did not enjoy being without Danny. He's much better at this playoff scenario stuff than I am. It took me like probably 2.5 hours to break all this down for you. And hopefully I got it right and it wasn't too confusing. And we'll talk to you all tomorrow night. Till then.